Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. And you can always visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, or follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching MedTech Money on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. MedTech Money is an interview-style podcast focused on demystifying raising and investing capital for MedTech startups. In episode 101, our guest, Richard Hanbury, and I discuss what he is working on at Sana Health, how he started this journey of solving pain, how he looked at the de novo process as a startup company, why breakthrough status was powerful for them, how he built his team, what to fractionalize and what to bring in-house, building a team to balance your gaps, his best advice for fundraising, paying attention to what motivates the type of investor you are pitching, what it is like taking on big pharma companies, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Richard Hanbury.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so let's start with just a brief intro into to who you are and what you do and a little bit of your background.
Sure. I'm Richard Hanbury, CEO of Sana Health. We do an audio-visual neuromodulation with this wearable that someone puts on, turns on. They're getting pulses of light through closed eyes and pulses of sound through their ears. And that is generating essentially anxiety relief on demand. So we are going through pivotals for fibromyalgia, neuropathic pain, and about to start on anxiety.
And Sana, so it's S-A-N-A for the people who are just listening in? Okay, perfect. Yeah. And website-wise, what is that? Just sanahealth.com?
Or sana.io.
.io, perfect. And I'll have a link to this in the show notes as well. So if you're listening, you should go check this out because it's a pretty cool product. Richard, what about a little bit of background about you, how you got here, and then we could dive a little more into Sana.
Certainly. Well, the name of the company comes from Sana'a in Yemen, and also it means healthy in Latin. But age 19, I was driving a Jeep down a road in the Yemen near the capital Sana'a, and I had a split second choice of head-on collision next to a petrol truck or to go off a bridge. In that split second, I had an image of my dad wandering around the country trying to find remains, and I figured we were dead either way, but if I went off the bridge, there'd be something for him to find. So off a bridge, 60 foot down into a dry riverbed, and that resulted in a spinal cord injury, THC-10, so I'm still in a wheelchair now, traumatic brain injury, aortic tear, a bunch of other broken bones, and all of that resulted in a nerve damage pain problem that was so severe I had a five-year life expectancy. So I made the first version of the device to be a better painkiller. Turned out that it actually fixed all of my pain, but that was not the original aim. I didn't believe that was possible. But yeah, that's the start of the company.
Whoa, hold on a minute. Okay, so this was when you were 19. This happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And so when did you, so you're one of the founders or are you the founder?
I'm the founder. So I've had 30 years of, I fixed my own pain with the first version of the device in 1993. And then basically it was laptops, wires, boxes, wasn't possible to make it into a wearable, which is what it needed, until, well, 2015, I relaunched the company because wearable technology was beginning to catch up with what I knew I wanted to build.
Yeah.
And then started building the company from that. Now we're a company of 24 and I have a great team. So it always sounds weird to me when I say sole founder, because it makes me sound like I'm out somewhere on my own. But yeah, Now I have a totally indispensable team that basically enables, it doesn't even enable me, it enables us as a team to to realize the original vision I had of what I wanted to build.
Yeah. Wow. That's this is incredible. So 2015, you relaunched the company, you converted into a wearable. What phase are you in? I guess from a fundraising perspective, what have you raised so far? And also, you know, where are you at in terms of next steps? Are you about to go for FDA clearance? What kind of device is it from an FDA perspective? EU or is US the first target?
US is first target. We've raised 22 million to date. We're raising another 5 right now.
Okay.
Thank you. And we are about to make the first full De Novo submission to the FDA this month.
Great.
And we've got 2 more in process. And COVID has basically meant that we're going to end up with 3 FDA indications happening in fairly short succession in the next 12 months. So the sort of traditional medical device of, well, you get 1 FDA indication, then you go raise a bunch more money cheaper and then go do your next ones. We haven't been able to do that. So we are aiming at 3 in the next 12 months.
Okay. Great. So a few things I want to get from your experiences that I think is crucial. One, it's the De Novo submission and how you've looked at that as a company, because I think that, you know, a lot of times we talk to customers and there's a decision between a 510K or a De Novo, and it's really based on the claims you want to make. Some people don't have a choice, right? But others do based on how they, you know, their strategy. And a lot of people fear a De Novo. Was that something that you feared, or was it something you embodied because it kind of showed that you were, you know, there's nothing like you on the market?
I'm going to, that's a very good question. So I think originally we did want a 510K. The FDA said no, has to be a De Novo. And then breakthrough status became a thing. And breakthrough status still is a thing. It's going through changes, but especially if you have something that is being delivered in hospital, breakthrough status is still a very, very powerful thing. So if you have the choice of going through for breakthrough device status, if you hit those criteria of solving something that's life-threatening, and being either the first thing or significantly better than current options, then I would advise everyone who fits those criteria to look at breakthrough status very seriously. Because not just of the speed it gets you through the FDA, but also because of how it can potentially speed up reimbursement. Reimbursement under breakthrough status is obviously a little bit unknown now for some things, but NTAP and hospital delivery of stuff. If you are being delivered through a hospital, breakthrough status is already right now, without any further changes to the legal situation, a very powerful addendum. So that's kind of like, it's in my mind, it's not really the question of De Novo or 510K. It is, can you get breakthrough status? In which case you 100% go De Novo, if you have the choice. And if you can't do breakthrough status, I'm not sure there's a real value to De Novo if you, rather than 510K, if you have a choice.
Okay. Yeah.
But, no, but I haven't been in that situation. So that is something someone should check out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, it's great advice. I mean, I think a lot of times what we try to do is relate regulatory strategy to business strategy and how do you leverage these things? Cause I think sometimes people look at regulatory as a box you just have to check over here. And I don't, you know, that's, it is, but it also can be leveraged into your business strategy as well. So I appreciate that background. One of the other main points.
Yeah, definitely. There's one thing that if someone had said to me a while ago, it would have been really helpful. Maybe they did say it and I didn't internalize it, but it is you don't start with your clinical strategy. You start with your reimbursement strategy, and then you back from that into your clinical strategy, and you back from that into your trial design. And that's not the way around that almost anybody does it. The very best people do it, but the rest of us who are coming into this just take a while to catch up. That's the way to do it.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And I think, you know, that's something we focus on with clients as well, as, you know, they start with regulatory. And again, that's just, you got to start with commercialization and reimbursement and then work your way back and figure out where you need to be. So that's great advice. The other point that I kind of wanted to get your take on is the building of your team, right? So while you are a startup, you know, you've raised a significant chunk of capital. You have a pretty sizable team. Maybe talk about, you know, how you thought about it as CEO and founder on how you built that team, some of your first hires, you know, what kind of culture were you trying to instill? Because that's a good size team. So there's got to be a lot of thought that went into that.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I was part of the Hacks program from SOSV.
Yeah.
And that was my first sort of experience of team building. I hired two people to join me to go to that. And I made my first mistake, but I learned a lot from it. There is a really interesting, useful tool called the Herman Brain Dominance Indicator, and that Hacks introduced us to. And what it does is it divides people up into different cognitive skills and propensities, and essentially it's the four quadrants of the four original Star Trek characters of Kirk, Spock, Bones, and Scotty. And whichever dimension you as a CEO are strongest on, you typically have weakness in the opposite one. So the more lateral visionary thinker you are, the worse you are on the details. The better you are on the details, the worse you are on the visionary. And likewise with the strategy and the people skills. Basically, you need that whole, you need all four of those quadrants covered in your very early team. Otherwise, you're in real trouble. And there are, you know, you see a lot of startups. I have friends who've done jobs across tech, including medtech. And I think medtech does suffer from the same tech diseases. That typically you quite often, not typically, but very often you have tech heavy founders who then really miss out on the people skills. And that creates a toxic environment as you grow. You've got to have those four bases covered. It doesn't have to be with four people, but you've got to know where you're good and where you're not good. The first time I met my original CEO, COO, who helped me build the company, I offered her a job within the first hour. She then took 15 hours of due diligence, having sort of said she wanted to do it, 15 hours of due diligence to take the job. So you can kind of already hear from that who's on the sort of Scott dimension and who's on the Kirk dimension. But it's like you've got to fill those quadrants. Otherwise, you get an unbalanced team. And then you've got to decide what matters to you as a company. But yeah, I think medtech suffers the tech thing of too many times the people part is left out, mm-hmm. Or the vision part is left out, or the strategy part is left out. You have to hit all four.
Yeah, that's great advice. I mean, I hear people talk about it in a variety of different ways, right? Which is just, you know, how do you as CEO balance out your weaknesses, right? And it's something that I did at Project MedTech when I was starting the company, and I've seen other good entrepreneurs do the same thing. The other comment I had is, so SOSV and Hacks, Duncan Turner, who's one of the managing partners there, he was episode one of Project MedTech. And so, yeah. And by the time this airs, this will be pretty close to 100, which will be kind of cool. Yeah. So anyways,
yeah, Duncan, they were our first money in.
Oh, great.
And they've been with us the whole journey. Mm-hmm. They put money into us when we didn't have the solution together, especially in terms of like measuring what we were doing. And at the time, they did a very large amount of non-medtech, and we were one of the very first medtech, and now they're almost entirely medtech. Yeah. But, you know, astonishingly great, helpful group that have, without whom there's no way we would have survived those mm-hmm. early year or two.
Yeah. And I think, you know, too, that so that you're not the only, like, there's a company that we do some consulting with that they were the first money in. And, you know, it's just it's a great group. And it's also rare that a group that size is willing to get in that early. So culture, building of the team, what about building out, you know, the rest of that team? I mean, how did you kind of make decisions on what to fractionalize and maybe what to take in-house?
So I, as you can probably hear from some of the things I'm already saying, I'm the one that's extreme on the Kirk dimension. Mm-hmm. You really want your Scotty person to be making those kind of decisions. Mm-hmm. You want the detail-oriented executional person to be logically thinking through, okay, what do we want internally and what do we want to outsource? Our original philosophy, which is still kind of the same, is, okay, well, what do we need to be a core competency, and what do we not need to be a core competency? But it is, I mean, those are really complex discussions. The one area that I would sort of go into before that, if you're talking about those very early stages, is I wouldn't start with the team and the building out. I would start with what you actually need to do. And the term minimum viable product is thrown around a lot, and people are shooting for their minimum viable product. My view is that in our space, that is completely wrong, and that leads a lot of people astray. And actually, the relevant term is minimum viable data. If you're in medtech, that's the phrase that you want running through your head the whole time when you're deciding everything from the early stages. It's what is the minimum viable data that gets me to the next proof point on my ladder? Because once you know, okay, we need to do this, this, and this, therefore the team we need is that. That's the way it goes in my mind. And setting those milestones based on what's the data that gets me to the next level, is the right way of looking at it. I was talking to a company just recently who had spent 3 years getting a really good app together for their digital health therapy. And they didn't have any user data. And it's like, okay, so you're on the App Store and you're on the Play Store, but you haven't tried this on people. Like, this is wrong. Just, no, get 20 people tomorrow to stick a tablet in front of them and get user feedback and get experience of beginning and end of that app experience and how their any biometric that you can measure with a handheld wearable or any questionnaire that you can get that early data, because that's the data that's going to drive your next angel check or your next seed check. So I would always start with minimum viable data and then work from that. Okay, the next data proof point I need is X. So who do I need to achieve that proof point? That's the way I think about it now. And I think within that, it's also really important to make the differential between thinking that credibility or data is a bar that you have to cross, that wasted 2 years of my life. Data and credibility is not a bar, it's a ladder. And you have to be thinking about what is the tiniest, smallest, quickest next step I can take. And that shortcuts a whole host of problems. Does that make sense?
That 100% makes sense. I think there is something within what you just said that will be worked into the title. I'm just not sure on how to do it just yet. But this was good. I really love the minimum viable data, but also that data and credibility is a ladder.
I mean, I literally wasted 2 years trying to get. I was in the Bay Area at the time, getting UCSF, Stanford, or Berkeley to do a large enough study to be, you know, what I was shooting for, the gold standard of credibility. And you if you come from academia, you typically can sit on a salaried job and collect a little bit of data. That little bit of data allows you to go get a grant that gets you a larger piece of data before you then step out of academia. But anybody who's not coming from academia has this trap of you need money to get data and you need data to get money. So you're stuck in this little loop. So you need people like Hacks to take a flyer on you when you haven't got the data.
Right.
But once I realized that this whole bar thing was totally wrong and I'd been barking up the wrong tree, I literally rang my local meetup group and said, hey, can you give me 20 volunteers to sit down and use a device versus a sham in a room in Berkeley that I hired for the afternoon? And we got 20 volunteers. And, you know, looking back, there are some things I would have done differently. Like I would have got someone to write me an IRB protocol so that data was cast iron from the start. But you don't need to be that clever when you first start. You just need any data in any way that you can possibly get it that's ethical and quick and safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now this is great advice. It also ties into an episode we did about 50 episodes ago around voice of customer, and how important that really is. And so, yeah, this is really good advice.
On the voice of customer bit, I would say two things on that. One is I'd say you test on your team first, healthy, well people. Yeah. And then as soon as it passes muster with your team, then it is get the first people that you can find that have the thing that you're trying to help. Because the two aren't the same. We created a sham version of our device for clinical trials that on a team where it was a very good sham. Mm-hmm. Handed that over to people with fibromyalgia and suddenly the whole thing broke. So it is important to test as quickly as you can on your team and then as quickly get it to your actual end user as you can.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so I have, I guess, two or three topics left, looking at the time. What, in terms of raising capital, what is your best advice for entrepreneurs who are just, you know, starting out? They're in that family and friends seed round. They've listened to the podcast. They're trying to get a feel for what it's like. Everyone's telling them you don't know what it's like until you do it. But what is your, you know, what you've taken from what you've raised so far, what's your best advice for them?
The very best advice is make what you're doing down to the simplest thing possible that you can then de-risk. It is very, the speed of the process is so much faster if you have something very simple. The simpler the story you can tell, the easier fundraising gets. I mean, we're essentially developing a platform with multiple indications. That is really hard to do, and I would not advise anybody to do that. If you can the narrowest niche you can get on the narrowest people who really need your help, refine down to what that tiniest denominator is, and then what's the data that de-risks that step. The simpler you can make it, the easier your fundraising will be. And that's the nugget. So for example, I know people who are doing sort of really good EEG stuff. They worked out how to create a business model where, oh, in the hospital, it takes them this much time and costs them this much money to do this one test. With our device, they can do it in half the time and half the money. That simplicity has allowed them to grow much, much faster than we ever managed. Mm-hmm. So the simpler the story, the simpler the data you can make it. And the thing is, we all love what we do, right? So we all want to find all the millions of different ways that it can help and it can work. That does make it harder. And that's a mistake that I still carry on making. For historic reasons now, we're kind of in a position where that's really hard to not do. But if you're starting out on your angel stuff, really important. And the other thing is to remember is like the risk profile changes. So when you're talking to angel investors, they are making a choice between their kid's college fund and you. Mm-hmm. So their risk profile is very different from a VC, where you're going into a portfolio and they want you to be, you know, a 10x minimum or 100x or fail. If you're a 2 or 3x, they really don't care. You've not moved the needle. Angel investors, again, it's college fund or you. 2 or 3x to an angel investor is great. They're not going to cry about that at all. A VC is just not going to care. Mm-hmm. They're going to care about you, and they're going to care about it, but in terms of their fund, you're not going to move the needle.
Right.
And family offices, very similar to the angel side. It is, you know, wealth preservation matters to them. Mm-hmm. If you think about a typical family office, if you return 100x on their investment, you're not going to move the needle probably on their family's overall wealth.
Yeah.
So they care about impact. They care about wealth preservation. They don't care about the 10 or 100x. But the 10 or 100x to a VC enables them to go raise the next round. So really pay attention to what the motivation is of the group that you're trying to talk to, what their financial dynamics are. Because everyone's got a hard job to do. Does that make sense?
100%. It's a good breakdown of the knowing who you're pitching to. And then I also think, you know, understanding the dynamics of a VC, and that's why we spend so much time on MedTech Money, talking to VCs about the mechanics of how their fund works, because that information is really important for a entrepreneur. Because, I mean, just understanding where they're at in the life cycle of their fund. You know, did this fund start in 2018 and now they're wrapping up their last few investments? That could change what they're looking for versus 3 years ago. And so understanding all of that is really important for entrepreneurs as they pitch to these funds.
Yeah, totally. And it's very, we've been extremely lucky as a company, I think partly because, and I think this is true across MedTech, there are so many easier ways of people and VCs to make money than MedTech. That the people who end up in MedTech, there is a large degree to which all of them, all of the VCs, all of the investors are trying to make the world a better place. If they're not, then why would they be in MedTech? MedTech is not an easy way of people making money. There is a sort of perfect asshole deterrent right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
If you're outside of MedTech, I think people have to be much more careful about who they take money from. Because I think, you know, I think those dynamics come into place. But, you know, in MedTech, I think it's bearing in mind that, you know, everyone is in it to some degree to make the world a better place or not, as well as return money to their investors.
Yeah, no, it's great advice. I want to pivot just a little bit, because it's something that the first time we had met, I guess I had picked up on right away. So when what your product is competing against is not what traditional med tech companies we engage with generally are generally, you know, hey, if you're an orthopedic, you're competing against Zimmer or Stryker, or if you're Smith and Nephew, and if you're in cardiovascular, you're competing against Medtronic and Edwards and all these things, right? It's always a behemoth, right? In your scenario, it's slightly different because you are competing against pharma. And that is without a doubt 100 times harder, because the amount of capital those pharma companies have are just dwarfs med tech. So I'm curious on what that's been like for you, and what kind of confidence or just in terms of like grit it took to say, you know what, I'm going to take on some of these big pharma companies.
Oh yeah, good questions. I mean, so it's a very good question. I don't know. I mean, for me, it was basically I'm going to die unless I solve my pain problem. Meditation is a really bad idea because it just teaches me how much pain I'm in. So I need an external source to do it. So I came from a whole, okay, now I've used this audiovisual simulation to fix my pain. How can I help other people now? Who was going to object to that didn't enter my thinking. It probably should have done. But I think it's a bit later on that you really have to think through some of those things. And then you have to think through, well, who actually is going to benefit from what I'm doing. There are medical devices that I know that had a really hard time in the migraine space because of the migraine drugs companies slamming them. But I just talked to someone in a conference this week where he's just started to have the opposite happen. He's getting offers from pharma because they're realizing that they have to get into the drug device combo game. So I think attitudes are changing. I think it all comes down to still, you know, what data can you go get that proves out what you're doing, and then go find your natural allies. We pitched to Novartis saying, hey, you've got a drug that anxiety is the largest cause of non-compliance, and if you use our device, we can solve your compliance problem. And they were super interested. It hasn't come to anything yet, but that is a good example of like there are allies out there, and if you figure out who's going to benefit from what you're doing, that really helps.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great advice. Anything else in closing? I know we asked about your best. You've given a bunch of nuggets of good advice, but you know, we asked about the raising capital advice in terms of if there's a first time entrepreneur, a young entrepreneur, someone who's thinking about starting a company. What's your best advice for them?
Don't worry about dilution. The chances of failing versus the chances of running out of money is your biggest risk always. So always take what's on the table. Don't worry about dilution. Try and raise as much money as you can each time you go and raise. That gives you time between raises to then prepare for the next raise properly. I've still not managed to do this. I am intent on doing this for the next fundraise, where you know, give yourself a year's breathing room, and then during that year, every month or every quarter, be sending an update email to everyone you've spoken to who might be interested in the future of how you're ticking through the milestones. Because if you can create that reputation for, oh yeah, this is a guy that said he was going to do X in a year's time, and it's a year later and he's done X. Or it's a year and a half and he's he's done X and he's done a little bit different in different areas. But getting that track record and that reliability and getting your sort of customer relationship management process down, my life would have been a ton easier had I done that properly. Otherwise, you end up running around like a headless chicken, talking to hundreds of people, and then forgetting half the people you talk to until someone says, oh, you should really talk to this person. And then you realize that you spoke to them 3 years ago and you failed to keep up with them. You know, so get ahead of the game if you can. If you can get organized early, get those systems in place to help you keep track of every person you ever speak to, because this is all about people knowing you. It's relationships over time. I would have a 10 times easier job if I'd done that from the start.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice. Awesome. Richard, hang on for a minute. We'll chat offline, but I really appreciate your time today. This has been great. You left a lot of great advice, and also it's not every time that someone gives me a title in the middle of a podcast. So that was super nice as well. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.